Expression. This is Heather, and I will be your host for this episode. Today, we have assembled a panel of people to give you a quick rundown and response to an article that recently came out in a Mormon magazine. And on that panel, we have Glenn. Hello, Glenn.
Hello, Heather.
Hello. And you have brought on a couple of people who are newbies to Mormon Expression, so why don't you introduce them and have them say a little something about themselves.
Yeah, this is Jake and Erica, who I have home taught for the last year, but I guess I'm not your home teacher anymore. They released me.
They did.
Yeah. Yeah, so you want to say a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. I'm Jake. We got married a little over a year ago. I grew up in Arizona, and we met in high school.
Awesome.
I'm Erica. We are at school right now. And, yeah, are in the ward with Glenn.
And we also have with us Randy. Hello, Randy.
Hello, Heather.
How are you doing these days?
Oh, it's great to be here. I'm here in Zion still. The original Zion, the failed Zion.
Where we'll all be pushing our hand carts, second coming comes around.
Yeah, you guys got a long way to travel. I'm just down the highway.
And then we also have Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hey, Heather.
So, anybody want to give us a little idea or a little synopsis of what we're talking about today?
I can jump in and do that.
Go for it.
There was an article in Meridian Magazine, and I tried to do a little bit of research on Meridian Magazine. As I understand it, it is a for-profit magazine that was started by a couple that's geared towards true-believing Mormons. They are not financed by the church. They're not officially or formally affiliated with the church, but effectively an online magazine with articles and a lot of advertisements that are whose target demographic is absolutely true believing Mormons, and specifically on the in the Utah area. But there was an article that came out August 17th, 2011, by a Jeff Sturer, who is a family therapist, and the topic is discussing pornography with your future son-in-law. And the gist is he is advocating when men come to ask for their future wife's hand in marriage, that the father of to-be bride should effectively do a PPI, or a personal priesthood interview, where the subject matter is all about the fiancé's
pornography consumption.
Pornography use and how he overcomes it and deals with it currently.
Yeah.
It's pretty exciting.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, the way that he writes the article, he starts with an anecdote about his own experience 15 years ago in 1996 when he went and had a nice little sit-down chat with his future father-in-law, and how that turned out really nice. And he just paints this picture about how very reasonable it is for a father-in-law to be, or for a father to be protective of his daughter in, you know, screening the would-be suitors of the daughter. And he, at one point, he references the proclamation of the family. And, you know, he sets this up as a very reasonable thing. But he says, you know, this was 1996, it was 15 years ago. My father-in-law didn't ask me about pornography, but today you might expect a question about pornography to come up. So how would we prepare for that?
Yeah, and you mentioned, 1996, dial-up internet was just coming out. And for those of you that experienced dial-up porn, it was very frustrating. So,
yeah.
One frame at a time. It was just excruciating.
Yeah. Excruciating.
No live streaming, no video.
So let me ask this question, though, because, you know, he presents this as a very reasonable position for a father to take. And, you know, I have two daughters myself. And so I could kind of say, yeah, I mean, I can see that as a father, I'd want to protect my daughters. I mean, is this a reasonable thing?
Well, which part, Glenn, just asking, the first part that I found interesting, or that I guess take a little umbrage with, is asking your father, your future father-in-law's permission, or even blessing for essentially your daughter, your fiancé's hand in marriage. I view that as just archaic and almost a sexist tradition. I didn't follow it. I didn't subscribe to it. And that part of it, I just think is I don't like it, I guess.
I agree. I think there's a bit of patriarchy there, and it's kind of built into the LDS system. Like Glenn said, he referenced the proclamation to the family and how it's the father's duty to oversee these kinds of things. But I personally don't see a problem with parents being concerned, you know, for the welfare of their children and wanting to make sure that their children are making appropriate choices in who to marry. But it seems entirely inappropriate to me that that conversation would happen between the father and the son-in-law. If anybody, that conversation should happen between, it would be the daughter and her parents about what things, you know what I mean? Like, these are the concerns we have, and we would hope that you would consider them in choosing a mate, type of a thing.
I think one other thing that's playing into this is that keeps this traditional life in the Mormon culture is that Mormons get married so young, and so you still kind of, mm-hmm. like, you know, I married my wife when she was 19 and I was 22. She was still just a kid in her father's eyes, and, you know, I could see the protective nature of the father still playing into it. But if you have, like, in a normal secular world where the woman's 30 and the man's 35 or 34 or whatever, it's between two adults, so the idea of going to the father is absurd at that point for permission. But I think in the Mormon culture, the women particularly are so young that's mm-hmm. why this tradition still continues on.
So then, Randy, you would think that there at least to some degree, it's reasonable for, in the words that the author uses, is paternal protectiveness. So
yeah.
You think that it's reasonable to some extent when the child bride is so young?
I don't say reasonable. I would say understandable.
Okay.
From their paradigm, from their point of view.
Okay.
And you know, like you, Glenn, I'm very protective. I anticipate being protective of my daughters. I have two daughters, and I have certain, expectations or standards that I would like them to look at. Education, being able to, being treated a certain way, being able to sustain yourself financially, these are all going to be things that are going to be reinforced. I think the thing that I found troubling about this is, also in the Mormon community, these guys may only have contact with their father-in-law for a month before they're getting engaged in some cases, and this is one of the first meaningful conversations that this guy's advocating
right.
fathers having with these their future son-in-laws.
Well, let me ask, because I've got Jake and Erica sitting right here, and they're both pretty young. You've been married for, what, a year?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was your experience like with this?
Well, I think even in the middle of Utah Valley, I think the idea of asking the dad, you know, the son-in-law asking the father for his, you know, his daughter's hand in marriage or whatever, I think it's mostly symbolic now. I think even when, say, the parents don't agree, I think at the same time, lots think, well, they're adults, they'll do what they want. And I think it's mostly a symbolic thing now. At least that's what I experienced with my friends. But anyway.
Well, in my experience, I never actually asked Erica's dad for her hand in marriage or anything. There was a point at which he pulled me aside and said, you know, I just want you to know that, you know, I love my daughter and I really respect her and I hope that you treat her respectfully. But that was essentially it. There wasn't this conversation. And I think that was, I don't know who was saying, who was talking right before this, because I don't know how to, I don't recognize the voices yet. But when they talk about this is the first meaningful conversation that they have with the father-in-law, who said that?
That's Matt.
Matt.
Okay. I really agree with that, because I feel like that this type of conversation, I mean, I think it just kind of sets the future son-in-law up to have a deceptive relationship with the father-in-law, because I mean, if Erica's dad had asked me any of these questions, there is no way I would have been honest at all about, like, you know, about anything, about any experience with pornography, anything like that, you know, my raging pornography addiction, that type of thing. I wouldn't have been honest at all about that. No, but there's no way I would have been forthcoming about any of that, any of those things. And it would have started, it really sets up the future son-in-law. I mean, you're going to have a deceptive relationship with them. You have to lie.
Not only that, you're setting up a precedent for what is okay in terms of boundaries and what your parents have the right to know about your relationship.
Right.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
In my opinion, these are very poor boundaries.
Yeah, sex on any level with the in-laws, it should be like out of the question.
it's just creepy as well. I mean, you're talking about my very personal private things. And I hardly know you, dude. I may have a father or other people in my life that I'm willing to come, but I owe you nothing. I may owe your daughter some explanations or some assurances about things, but it's kind of like, who the hell are you?
Yeah, yeah, totally.
I agree. So should we go over the discussion points that Mr. Struerer suggests?
I think the pronunciation is store, but because there was an elder store on my mission spelled very similarly. But
before we get to those, though, Heather, because I still have a question about this paternal protectiveness, because he doesn't say why. I mean, like, what is he protecting his daughter from?
Well, do any of you know somebody whose marriage is being ravaged by porn addiction?
I know of a marriage that ended over the woman catching the husband masturbating too many times. You know, it was kind of like a three strikes policy. And the marriage ended within a year.
Did you say a three strokes policy?
It was definitely. That's exactly what I said. It was a three strokes policy. And
if he could get it done in two strokes, he was in the group.
that was a birdie.
There was definitely definitely a premature climax to that marriage as it ended in this year.
Well, I have friends who are, you know, true TBMs or whatever, and I think that their expectations about pornography and men's sexuality is a little unrealistic, but I don't see, at least in my own personal experience, I haven't seen people get divorced simply because their husband is looking at porn. But I do know a couple of people whose husbands have real problems with porn, and so I think, I mean, I don't know what the church is. The church obviously considers looking at porn at all to be some sort of an addiction or a problem. But is there a possibility that, you know, the girl could be getting married to somebody who doesn't handle stress very well, and as an outlet for, you know, getting away from his problems, obsessively and neurotically consumes porn, and it causes problems in their intimacy? That can cause a lot of problems in a marriage. So I can understand if that's like on the rise, if that's becoming a more common problem in society, I can see paternal, you know, worry about that.
Sure, but it highlights a point, I think, that's really why this is a worthwhile discussion, which is it seems in the last 5 years at least, the members of the church, at least local members, and I think as well as leadership of the church, treats pornography and any use of pornography or any exposure to pornography as the ultimate plague on society, and I think that's the problem. It's why this? Why only pornography when financial problems, other sexual deviancy, abuse, anger, authoritarianism, I mean, all these things can be even more damaging to a relationship and to a healthy relationship than the consumption of porn.
It's spousal abuse, I mean, not several orders of magnitude more damaging to a marriage, and you very rarely hear in general conference, you know, explicit talks about spousal abuse, both psychological and physical, but you every conference you will hear about pornography and masturbation.
Right, and child abuse, quite frankly. I mean, child physical abuse. I mean, people are putting their hands on kids more frequently than we would be led to believe sitting in church.
And just as a vague reference, Matt knows what he's talking about professionally. He has access to just how bad it can be in our society.
Yeah, I mean, I am trained as a trial lawyer, and I do have some criminal law experience.
I was going to say, I think a lot of that has to do with the church's view of pornography is like singularly as the problem is men get into pornography and then they stop. They look to pornography for their sexual outlets instead of like their wife. And so it ruins their relationship. And like, that's kind of how they view it. And that's the only way that pornography exists in the world.
Instead of
women view pornography, couples view pornography together. And it, you know, some use it as an exciting way for their sex life. I mean, there are people who view it every once in a while. It's not an addiction. I mean, there's lots of levels. I mean, everyone can have their personal opinions about pornography, but I feel like the church sees it as just one. There's just one outcome of pornography.
Right. If you view it at all, you have a problem. Mm-hmm. There was even recently a video released by the church, and it showed a guy who was clean cut, happy, good family guy, and then he stays up late one night and starts looking at porn, and the next thing you know, he won't play with his children, he fights with his wife, and it gets worse and worse and worse until he is asked to leave.
Right. Wow.
And I think that's another part of the problem is that the church views there's no such thing as
a casual pornography viewer. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Right, and it's also that slippery slope concept that viewing pornography leads to insert any bad outcome, whether it be accessing child porn, whether it be touching a kid, whether it be neglecting your marriage and spending tons of – I mean, every – negative outcome is perceived as a natural extension of looking at porn, I believe in most members of the church's mind.
And I found it very interesting that slippery slope wasn't defined at all in this article. It was just assumed. And it's part of like the cultural ether where if you leave it vague enough, people can fill in the details themselves, and then you have all the stories that float around that people just take it as a given. And I think it's doing something else. I think it's functioning for something else, and we can talk about that later on. But, you know, you wanted to get to these questions, Heather, and I just thought before we got to these questions, it's, you know, kind of important to talk about what the father is trying to protect the daughter from, because it's a very real perceived danger, even if it isn't clearly defined, that pornography is, you know, terrible and destructive. And one of the things that the author does before he gets to these questions is he counsels the fathers that, you know, you might want to train your sons to be ready for receiving these questions from their potential future father-in-law. And if you yourself have a porn problem, you're not going to be able to talk to your son and prepare him for receiving these questions because you're going to feel guilty about it. So you better make sure that you repent. And it made me think, well, what about the kids who are asking for the daughter's hand in marriage if they've repented about it? Do they really need to drag up
right
things that they've repented of in this, you know, pseudo PPI with their potential father-in-law? But, you know, he's
right
there to weed out the potential problem. So,
and one of the things he talks about along the lines of it being vague is he says, I believe it's safe to assume that the young man has already been exposed to pornography.
Yeah.
What does that mean, being exposed to pornography? Because I did a little bit of research on this this guy, and he has another blog post on his website where he talks about being in the airport in Las Vegas and basically treating his kids, his boys, like they're in battle and how they need to hunker down and not divert their eyes because of even advertisements. So if he's calling. And I'm not talking about the stuff they hand out, you know, in on the strip or something like that.
If you've ever been to Salt Lake or the Las Vegas airport, there are like, you know, 20-foot pictures of showgirls.
Right, in bikinis or in, you know, scandals,
right.
And even in thongs, right? But if he's calling that pornography, you can kind of see. I mean, is a shampoo commercial pornography to him at some point, because oh my gosh, it shows her bare shoulders. I mean,
well, if it's herbal essence, it's a little bit more than that.
Right, right. It's orgasmic, absolutely. Yeah. So he does say, just point blank, all males have been exposed to it. So just know going into it, you know, it's not even a have you. It's kind of reminded of my mission interview when my bishop said, "When was the last time you masturbate?" And I said, "Don't I even get it? Do I?" You know, it's just assumed. What is your access? You know, your
when did you stop beating your wife, kind of thing.
Right. One other point before the questions, I thought it was really creepy. He says if there isn't a father in the home, I still think it's a good idea for the mother to have this conversation with the boyfriend.
Yeah,
that is creepy.
Well, but it serves a function. There's a reason he has it in there, but I'm not going to divulge what I think it is quite yet. I'm saving it.
Very good. Teaser. Nice, Glenn.
One of the most famous serial killers of all time is Ted Bundy, and Mormons are pretty aware of Ted Bundy because he killed some people in Utah. And when he was interviewed, like, on death row, do you guys remember what he blamed his psycho-killing habit to?
Pornography.
And I think most Mormons that are old enough to know who Ted Bundy is remember that, and that was, like, a warning sign, and you know, and to me that's ridiculous. His problem was he was a psychopath.
Right.
Not that he watched porn. That just focused his psychopathy, his violent psychopathy, in a certain direction, maybe. But it was definitely not. You're not going to turn into Ted Bundy. But I think a lot of Mormons see that slippery slope as that extreme.
Listen, I can say that a lot of criminals for a lot of different crimes. Will point to pornography because they recognize that people view that as such, you know, the ills of society and such a problem that they do use that in order to kind of deflect responsibility. You know, it's kind of like the video game thing. Well, the violent video games are what contributed. So you do get that a lot, and I just think it's conflated too often, and especially in the church.
I would agree. Definitely.
Well, I think that's what contributes to this kind of false dichotomy about pornography. Like, if you do or don't, if you do, you're Ted Bundy. If you don't, you know, you're good.
You're Joseph Smith,
right? So, like,
yeah.
Yeah, right, because that's the opposite end of the spectrum, right? So,
well, that's the view of, you know, the church membership. But this article doesn't leave open the window for there to be that dichotomy. He says that he like Matt was saying earlier, nobody gets a did I. It's all what phase of recovery are you in, and if you don't claim to be in a phase of recovery, you still have the problem.
Well, one other thing I want to ask generally about, I'm interested in get your everyone's take on pornography is do you think part of this is kind of like the idea of a Minority Report, you know, that kind of crappy movie with Tom Cruise where it's a thought crime, where if you watch pornography, it you will necessarily act at some point, whether it be an affair. Usually it's the idea of an affair, right? You're going to act out as an affair, or stop finding your wife sexually attractive, or stop being aroused by them if you're looking at pornography. Do you think that's really the view, is they conflate or they extend pornography with an affair?
Yeah, that the viewing the porn is like the precursor to the worser problems.
Well, there's the saying from Jesus that, you know, if you've done it in your heart, you've done it for real. You know,
right.
maybe not
upon
those exact
a woman,
words,
that type of thing.
Yeah,
yeah.
But, say that again, Jake.
Well, if you look upon a woman and lust after, you know, you committed adultery in your heart, you know, that kind of like the thought of the crime, kind of like the thought crime, just thinking it or doing it, you know, is the same spiritually as doing it.
Right. And I think there is damage in that concept.
I think there obviously are real problems with pornography. Obviously, Matt has dealt with them. Not in his life, but, you know, with his career. And so obviously that's real, but the way that this article is talking about it, it's like if someone actually had a problem, they would never feel comfortable enough to talk about it. You know, like if they're dealing with these questions, like how did you define pornography? Do you have a history of pornography in your extended family? You know, it's like, that's like asking someone, oh, are your parents divorced? Then maybe I shouldn't let you marry my daughter. You know, it's like, it's not a welcoming environment if you do have a problem. anything is a problem, and if you have it, I don't want to hear about it, you know? But well, I'm pretending like I do.
Here's the thing that I think is the most insidious thing in this whole notion of the father-in-law doing this, is what is he doing? He's creating a gigantic mountain out of a molehill right at the beginning of the marriage. Mm-hmm. And so let's say the son-in-law lies, and he's not very good at not getting caught watching porn for some reason. And so the daughter, you know, my father was so, this was so important to my father that he sat down my husband and grilled him on pornography. Now I catch him a couple of times. This is grounds for divorce, right? That's a ridiculous reason to get divorced.
Mm-hmm. And it's reinforced. One thing I will notice is friends that have been divorced or friends of friends, I joke about it at work all the time. They say, well, why did they get divorced? I said, well, are they Mormon? Pornography. And because that's the canned answer.
That's right? Horrible.
And it's such a simplistic view because problems in marriages, I submit, are a lot more complex than he really likes to look at tits.
Indeed, I agree. So the first discussion point.
And these are proposed questions that this air quote doctor proposes the future father-in-law to ask the son-in-law.
Right. Tell me about your experience with pornography over your lifetime. So your past sins aren't actually forgiven?
Don't you think you should define pornography before you ask question one?
Yeah. You're saying these are in a poor
horrible maybe order. Three should be first.
Yeah,
because he does ask that in about the third question is how do you define pornography? But absolutely, that's got to be first in order to even understand. You know, you got guys, I don't know. I mean, I used to watch my mom get out of the shower. I don't know. What does this count, you know?
Just, pretty edible there.
Oh, dear. Yeah, I can't imagine sitting there with your soon-to-be father-in-law and having to define pornography.
And this, I think, can members of the church, do you think that there's an agreement on what pornography is in
no.
the church?
No.
It's everything from an advertisement.
Well, hang on. Yes. Yeah, I do.
Okay. Well, give it. What
yeah,
do you think
an
agreed upon one would be?
It's pornography.
Ah, right.
You know it when you see it, like the Supreme Court justice, right?
That's yeah. obscenity, dude. There's a big difference between pornography and obscenity. But I bring that up because I've talked about it before. I had an elders' quorum president who was obsessed with pornography lessons, and one time he brought a panel of women from the ward in. It was the most uncomfortable experience
wow.
in my life to talk about pornography. And as they started talking, they literally started talking about at commercials on the television, and I immediately flew up my hand and said, whoa, are we talking about pornography, or are we talking about you know things that you can see every day? And the answer was yes, and then I'm out.
Have you seen those shake weight commercials?
That is a good point.
Yeah,
those are hot.
Because you've always got people that take things to an extreme, you know, and they say, well, we're supposed to avoid the very appearance of evil, and so, you know. But
well, and you also have this idea that we're living in the last days and our entire society is corrupt and fallen
yep.
and pornified.
Oh, yeah. That's the huge undercurrent here.
Right.
I think that's the massive undercurrent here.
And it is kind of that Mormon one-upmanship. Oh, you don't drink coffee? I don't drink Coke. Oh, you don't drink Coke? I don't drink Sprite. This is, oh, you don't look at, you know, Triple X? I don't look at Playboy. I don't watch TV. You know, I mean, it really
I don't even watch college cheerleaders with their short right. skirts. That gives me impure thoughts.
Right.
So then the next one, is there a history? This one is just blew me away when I read this one. Is there a history of pornography use in your immediate or extended family?
Like it's cancer.
Like, yeah, this is what you ask me for a physician looking for genetic diseases.
Right. It's inheritable.
If this guy is a therapist and he believes that it is truly an addiction, he would say that, yes, there is a genetic component.
Well, and maybe we should, I don't know if we should mention now specifically where he worked and what he has started, but he has started essentially anti-pornography and sex addiction clinic in St. George. So this is a little disingenuous to say how tragic this is, and what you really need is some treatment.
Well, wait till we get to the red flags and it becomes even more clear.
But, oh, yeah, it does. And I got to say, if this is what your job is and you're in St. George, business is good.
Yeah.
Well, anywhere in Utah, really. Right. The highest pornography use per capita, right? How have you healed from the impact of pornography on your life?
And that's a gotcha question.
It's a presupposition question. It presupposes that you have been, like, scarred, and now how did you heal?
Well, but it also presupposes that they've healed, and that's kind of a nice thing. So let's give them some credit there.
You are generous, Glenn.
Well, yeah. You know.
So here's an interesting one, and I think this would be worth sharing anecdotes. How do you currently protect yourself from pornography?
I use a condom.
Oh, you skipped one.
Oh, who helped? That's right. Who helped you overcome your problems with pornography?
Jesus.
Yeah. But this, so not this even goes, that's acceptable, though, because it says, well, when you get to the red flags, it says that if you just use Jesus, it's no good, you know?
Right.
Well, I gotta say, I love the pun that he uses. It was an unintended pun. If he white-knuckled it by himself.
That is true. I did like that, Randy. I caught that. Good pick-up.
Because I white knuckled it many times, and tell you, it's tough. I can't.
So, you guys familiar with that Sons of Helaman or whatever?
Oh, I've heard of it, but
it's a group to help pre and post missionary age young men overcome masturbation and pornography, and there's all sorts of crazy suggestions they have. Like, you're supposed to reach out and get help from people, but at the same time there's this advice that you shouldn't be seeking support from people who also, I know, reach out. There you go.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting point, though. You know, there's this focus on pornography. I mean, does pornography necessarily, is that necessarily connected with masturbation, do you think, when they're talking about pornography? Is that kind of is it kind of a, in their mind, a cleaner way to talk about self-abuse?
Well, I don't think either is okay. I mean, it's not like you'd be sitting with your bishop and the bishop would say, "Oh, you don't masturbate when you look at porn? Well, then you're fine. Get out of here."
Or what if you masturbate and not to porn? Use porn?
No, but they would probably look at it as degrees of perversion and say, "Okay, well, it hasn't devolved into, you know, masturbation while looking at pornography, so it you know, you still have a little bit more hope." I don't know. But
I can say anybody who uses pornography without masturbating, I just have no concept of that. It is tedious to watch porn if you're not going to use it to masturbate.
Amen, friends.
All right.
No, but can I tell
really compelling.
Yeah. can I tell a true story about when I was a kid, when I was in high school, at least, or a teenager? I do remember being racked with guilt over masturbating and thinking, okay, it's okay as long as I don't associate it with pornography. And then it got to the point where I can touch myself as long as I don't get release. I mean, I can remember my warped Mormon kid, guilt, angst-ridden self trying to parse out how far I could go in degrees of a natural, freaking healthy thing.
Right. And not only that, but the religious prescription against it makes a person's desire to do it more intense and how can I use
enticing
words that are not enticing? Yeah. Yeah. It makes people want to do it more.
Yeah. Making it taboo, it caused more anxiety. It, as a result, you're going to do it more because it is self-soothing. You do get some sort of a release, mm-hmm. and then the guilt comes in. It's this cycle of guilt and release, and mm-hmm. it really is just a cycle that you put yourself through because of that. Rather than, okay, it happens. Do it in private. Don't let it take over your life and affect your lifestyle, and then move on.
Right. Yep.
You know, one of the things that I'm giving an intro to the final question here, but one of the things when he's talking about the asking questions, he says avoid asking yes or no questions. But the final question that he gives here is like a yes or no. It's a leading question with a yes or no. And the correct answer is no. But it's hilarious because it could mean a couple different things.
You never wanted to stop viewing porn.
Have you ever wanted to stop viewing pornography? But and the correct answer is no.
I have never wanted to stop because it's so good.
It's kind of like the bishop asking the young kid, so do you have any problems with masturbation? And the kid saying, nope, it works fine every time.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so should we move on to the red flag?
Please.
Yes.
All right, so... Basically, the first one is he can't explain to you how or why he stopped looking at porn. He just says, yeah, I stopped. Couldn't possibly be that he's uncomfortable with the entire discussion and really doesn't want to talk about it.
Or that literally he maybe did as a child went through that, and maybe as he's gotten older, it just really is not something he's into as much anymore. I mean, I'm sure that happens. I have friends that tell me, absolutely, I just not really my thing. I don't mm-hmm. – so fine.
Like this is so troublesome to me, this first red flag. He admits that he used to look at it. He says he stopped doing it but fails to explain how. Man, if you still don't trust him, I mean, this is just like a recipe for how to continue to not trust anything that this guy says.
Or to have a really bad relationship with your son-in-law.
Like, he admits it. He says he stopped, but not how.
That's
a big step. Don't trust him.
That's a big step for him even to say, yeah, I did it, but I don't anymore. Well, I don't trust you now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you're damned if you do, damned
if you don't. How can you continue to live your life motivated by fear and mistrust? That's what we should title this article.
Not three strokes and you're out?
Well,
it's a working title.
Yeah.
And how to blast through a proper boundaries and alienate yourself from your future family.
Yeah.
I would say how to never see your grandchildren again.
Right.
Yeah.
Or at all.
Yeah.
So the next one is he claims to have overcome the problem without the help of others. That one bugs me too.
Well, the first part, he claims. I mean, this is just like sowing the seeds of mistrust all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
All over the place. It's like you're automatically supposing that he's lying to you.
And the problem I have with this is that this guy, you know, has this degree, he has these credentials, and he touts himself out as an expert. So to an unlearned member of the church who reads this is getting such misinformation that can then be perpetuated if they try to, use these techniques.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess I want to bring up something that you brought that up. I have a really close friend. He's a true believing Mormon. Obviously, I'm not going to mention his name, but he's a marriage family therapist, and his specialty is substance abuse, drugs, and alcohol. Well, he himself wanted to get rid of this habit, and so he's like, well, I'll go to my colleague. So he actually didn't go to a marriage and family therapist. He went to a psychologist, and he says, I have an addiction to pornography, and they're like, that's not an addiction. That's just being normal. And so he left that one, went to another psychologist, and they said, well, that's not an addiction. He finally went to a third one that would say, okay, I don't consider it an addiction, but if you want to stop the behavior, I can give you some clues on how to stop the behavior. So this is not viewed in mainstream marriage and family therapy or in psychology as a true addiction. And so this guy is making – it's almost like a fringy pseudoscience to me that he's setting up and making a problem that's not even really there.
You can't expect these worldly trained therapists to have access to the further light and knowledge that the gospel gives.
Touche.
But there I don't necessarily agree that the outside world doesn't view this as a problem. What is the
organization? I didn't say problem. I said addiction.
Addiction. Well, no, that's what I meant. The LifeStar program that the author of this article is involved with, that's not a church thing. That's a secular thing started by a group of therapists who deal with people who have sexual compulsion problems.
Well, hold on.
And so I do think there is a
sex addiction is not the same thing as consuming pornography.
No, that's where I was going with it.
I was going to say the
difference is that the outside world would say, so are you still having sex with your wife? Are you going to work? Is this having any negative impact in your life? You know, I mean, if you're if your life is going fine in every other way, you don't have a problem. You don't need to be here.
Well, I think
the distinction with the outside world is this actually a compulsion.
That's I probably should have brought up the key part to the story was that he was only doing it like 3-4 times a month, and he wanted to stop at it, and it was absolutely not affecting his ability to function as a productive society member, society, and a husband and father. So yeah, that's probably why they said this is not an addiction.
Yep.
Well, it's interesting. He has on his this store on his site. The first thing he has on his blog is a link to the American Society for Addiction Medicine, right? And he says they recently released an updated definition of addiction, which now includes sex and other process addictions like gambling, shopping, etc., but not pornography, if you notice. They recognize that people can get a high from these activities. It impacts their brain, emotions, relationships, and lives in the same way drugs and alcohol do. And then he goes through addiction characterized by, 1, the inability to consistently abstain. 2, impairment of behavioral control. 3, craving or increased hunger for drugs or rewarding experiences. 4, diminished recognition of significant problems with one's behavior and interpersonal relationships. And 5, a dysfunctional emotional response. So, you know, I guess those things can be attributed to an unhealthy view of pornography or sex. But even here, he acknowledges pornography is not recognized as being on the list of recognized addictions.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I would submit that looking at pornography is not actually the problem. It's the pornography is the tool to escape the problems of your life. There's something else that you are escaping from in your life if you are neurotically consuming pornography.
And that last clause is the critical part. Not just if you're viewing pornography, but if you're neurotically doing it, and if it's impacting your life where you're taking a sick day so I can watch, you know, so somebody can watch porn all day long.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Number 3, are we on
three
number 3?
Three red flags.
Yeah, he has not said anything to his girlfriend or fiance about his history or current problem with pornography.
Yeah, and why would you? Did anyone talk to their girlfriend or spouse initially about, hey, let me tell you about my pornography consumption. I'd really like to have a Playboy subscription, but I know you won't allow me to, so this is where does anyone do that?
No, and I think it also goes back to if you've repented of it, then it's as if it never happened, right? I mean, I don't know about your guys' experience, but I know that there have been times where in a purity lesson, the girls have been told, if you do slip up and you repent of it, your future spouse does not need to know.
I remember I actually did tell my fiance about the times, and, you know, I had watched Playboy Channel or things like that occasionally in my youth. I didn't have any kind of a regular habit, but I told her about that, and she was so embarrassed about it. When she mentioned to her mom that I had some minor discretions, she masked it and said that I had drank coffee. I had totally forgot about that until this moment.
Oh, that's very good.
He is vague about how he keeps himself from viewing pornography. That's, again, presupposing that he has a problem that he's trying to control.
Or that there's any reason in the world why he would be open with the father-in-law, or that he needs to be open with the father-in-law. There's so many other reasons why he would be vague. Why does this have to be a red flag
like
that
being
there's a
specific,
problem?
Well, like being specific means that he's being honest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I know what answers they want. I can give them very specific answers that they want.
And just be like, this is not any of your business. Oh, red flag.
Right. Well, no, I think Randy just made a really good point, though. If you do have somebody who actually does have a porn problem and has tried to conquer it in the past, they know exactly what tools they've used in the past to try to stop. So why wouldn't they just bring up those? He admitted to having a problem with it, but doesn't define exactly what the problem was. He appears defensive and doesn't want to discuss it. Yeah, I don't know that there's much to say about that.
If he behaves if he responds appropriately, that's a red flag. That's really what that's.
Exactly. Yep. Or if he insists that he's never seen pornography and appears too perfect in his responses.
Right. So you're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't.
You don't.
There's no right answers, man. I mean, this is a trap. I mean, it's a black hole.
And there's more to this one, you know, because he says he goes on to say recognize that even though he may not have seen hardcore pornography, We live in a culture saturated with pornographic images. If he acts like he doesn't notice or isn't affected by those, you need to be concerned. Every man should acknowledge the occasional pull. He said an occasional pull. From images that are designed to draw our attention and entice us. I mean, this guy, I don't want to be his neighbor.
No, well, I gotta say, this podcast is saturated with double entendres.
Yeah. What he's really saying is, I'm a ridiculous perv, and so are you. I mean, that's what I see. I am, you know, he recognizes that he's turned on by innocuous images, and so everyone else must too. So everyone has to be, because otherwise that makes me weird. That's what I read from that, because I think you can be exposed to certain images out there that might be even somewhat sexualized and not be affected by them.
Well, and I think this plays into the way that members view sex and how to talk about sex, period. Like, if instead of saying, oh, pornography or showgirls in Las Vegas are degrading to women, or by saying, I mean, there's lots of ways you can handle it that are a lot better. If you're really worried about pornography, then let's catch them. You know, like, there's lots of ways you can say, this is why this can be bad, or if this happens, then you know it's a problem, instead of, let's just be really vague and really pointed and really scary all the time, and maybe it'll all go away. Like, I don't know.
Well, I think that leads me a little bit to question, like, why is the church pushing pornography so much? Like, what is the purpose of being so, pulpit thumping and evangelical about eradicating porn? Like, what is the point? Are they really trying to help people spiritually out?
Oh,
Glenn has something. He's raising his hand.
This validates our whole reason for being as Mormons. It's not really even about pornography at all. It's about our Mormon identity. It's about living in the last days.
Last days.
Right? It's about how the world is going to hell in a handbasket, and it's getting more and more evil all the time, and Satan is winning battles right and left, and we can get right in the trenches and fight against him by doing things like this that are here. And, you know, look how bad and evil it's getting. But we are latter-day saints living in the latter days. It was prophesied that things like this were going to happen. Look, it's all around us. See, validation. Justification, proof, it's true. That's what this is about.
Amen, brother. I think that's exactly it.
So you don't think that it's because of an increased rate of men coming in having problems with internet porn?
Well, I think when you put that out there, it is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more you talk about it, the more you make men fixate on it, the more you tell them that there's these problems with the addiction, the more you're going to see that manifest.
Go ahead.
No, that's it.
Randy's example of a guy that was doing it, you know, 3, 4, 5 times a month and insisted that he had an addiction. Why? Because that's what he was being told that he had. Why? Because that's what the scriptures say is going to happen in the last days.
It's a manufactured crisis.
And for him, I think to be fair to the author of this article, Stuart, you know, the last two paragraphs, he kind of gets back to this reasonable language. I mean, you know, or at least from his point of view, is very reasonable that, you know, a man who is healed from pornography isn't afraid to talk honestly with those who need to know. I mean, you know, you can go and read it to get that. I think, you know, he's, from his point of view, he's being very reasonable about it. I still think that it's none of the father's business to do this.
We can't go that far and give him like, he got reasonable, without bringing up the fact that if the father-in-law suspects something's going on here, to postpone the marriage for a year.
Yeah, but hang on. The point that I wanted to make, Randy, was that, but by people playing this role, you know, they're engaging in a narrative and they're playing a role that involves repentance and contrition, and it just further reinforces this worldview by actual experience and actual feelings. So they can say, oh yes, I did have a pornography problem, but I overcame it and I'm a better person for it now today, whether they really had a pornography problem or not. But they all help each other and go through this charade, if you want to call it a charade, or exercise, or activity, or whatever it is, playing these parts and playing these roles. And that's what he's doing here. He's writing a script.
Well, no, I think that's a good point. You've got that will if a man feels he has a pornography problem because he looks at porn once or twice a month, and it weighs heavily on his heart, and it's something that gives him mental anguish, and he goes and talks to his bishop about it and begins the repentance process and frees himself of that activity and feels that he's been forgiven, then he has a little story to tell.
Yeah.
When he has to give a lesson on repentance, when he needs to bear his testimony. Yeah, I agree with Glenn. That's a good point.
I don't know how many guys are going up in front of Elders Quorum and saying, yeah, I had a pornography masturbation problem and I overcame it.
But how many men would get up and say, there was something I was struggling with in my life?
Right. And that could be it.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting I thought about as I was going through this. You know, it seems he takes this I think false premise that people who have gone through this and certainly recovered from it are absolutely open to discussing their pornography use. I think that's just not true. But do you really think it's possible to have a real productive and open conversation with, say, a true believing spouse about pornography consumption without getting just a horrific reaction?
Well, I don't think I was thinking about that, and I really don't think so because of the stigma that's built up around it, because of the church's like adamant, you know, hard line. You're Jeffrey Dahmer or you're Jesus. You look at it or you don't. So it creates an environment where an environment of secrecy, and it's really counterproductive if the purpose of this discussion for the church is to really help people spiritually. It's very productive if it's just to create an identity and a validation for people's membership in the church and living as Latter-day Saints. But it's really not that productive if the purpose is to actually help people spiritually who have a problem.
I also think that I don't know, this might be a horrible thing to say, but I think women have been given a very unrealistic expectation of male sexuality in the church. I was a part of an LDS discussion group online where a woman got on and was talking about how horrible this horrible porn problem in her marriage and how it made her completely rethink whether or not, I thought, you know, she was saying like, I thought I had a good marriage and all these times that I thought that we were in a happy, good, successful marriage. And now I find out that he looked at porn a couple of times every year and everything is just undermined now. You know, like there's no separation between a good marriage and looking at porn.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, that's what this whole article, like I said before, sets up that whole paradigm for the women who would be associated with this kind of a scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And I get the idea that women feel betrayed and they feel lied to, and if you're hiding – and here's what I've heard before, not in my marriage, but out there.
In a friend's marriage?
Yeah, no, because I can tell you – yeah. In my marriage, my wife at one point, 8 years in or so, said, heard something on TV and said, so almost all guys look at pornography. And I looked over at her and I said, yeah. And she paused for about 10 to 20 seconds and said, I think I'm okay with that. So that's kind of how ours were. But what I've heard is, if he's lying to me about this, what else is he lying to me about? And that, I think, is damaging and unhealthy.
Right, right.
You know, one of the things, Jake mentioned spirituality. And when I read through the comments that were on this website, the Meridian eZine website, one of the comments talked about the atonement and like forgiveness, you know, Christ forgiving people for their sins. And it surprises me when I read something from somebody who is clearly a believer, like the author of this article is, that there isn't any reference at all in here to Christ, to any kind of spirituality, to any kind of atonement or repentance for sin at all. It kind of troubles me in that sense.
Well, it's all about the action. It's not even talking about what impacts it could potentially have. That's not even in there. Like, there's not even proof for why this is a problem. It's just understood this is a rampant problem that has never happened when really pornography has existed since the beginning of time.
Yeah.
And that There's no discussion, and there's no, it's just understood. He doesn't even need to prove himself.
Right. It's all about setting up fear. And if you bring in something like Christ and the atonement, well, that would be a disincentive because that brings hope in, and you don't want that when you're trying to create an atmosphere of fear.
Well, that make you feel good about yourself. It would make you not loathe yourself so much.
Right.
What a great point. That kind of brings to his what I think is so nefarious about the article, which is his he is trying to get business out of this, and that's why he doesn't include that, I think, Glenn, the hope and the talk about the atonement and these possibilities, because the only way to really overcome this is to go get professional help at, I don't know, let's say a clinic that might specialize in the treatment of pornography and sex addiction.
Set of steak knives.
Absolutely.
That's the biggest red flag to me as this being a commercial.
Yeah,
is that he's saying that, I mean, and I don't believe in God, but if I was a believer and you're telling me that I can't handle this little problem between me and my God, that mm-hmm. is ultimately offensive to me if I believed in God, because what's, you know, he's basically saying that you need a therapist, and here I am.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, I'm looking through the comments on the LDSMag.com website, and last night when I was reading the comments, there was somebody who posted that we should beware people who claim that there's a problem and that there's only one solution to the problem and that they have that solution, and I can't find it now.
That was Jason.
You read that as well?
I copied it down. He said, be suspicious of men that have overcome the challenge without the help of a licensed therapist. And how convenient one can look at the top of the page and contact the author for the exact services that everyone needs. Be suspicious of therapists that create fear and shame that only they can resolve. Yeah, that was someone named Jason who put that on there. So props to Jason.
Indeed. And I think it's worth mentioning that there has not been a very favorable response to this article. You know,
no, but if the consumers of this e-zine or this online publication are true believings, and if the comments are representative of those who are going to that, then the rank and file Mormons are rejecting this en masse.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, though: they discussed this on By Common Consent. So all of those comments could be coming from people who are already on the liberal
right,
and
on anyway. The some of the Facebook group pages and
whatnot. Right. I mean, this, how did we find out about it? Through Facebook. And, you know, liberal Mormons are sending this to all their friends, and a lot of these people are just being drawn to this article probably more than their normal draw. And a lot of times I think true believers will read it and they'll think it's great and they won't comment. And especially if they go down and look at the comments and see all the, you know, negative comments, they don't want to be attacked.
Right.
So,
well, I posed this article to some of my TBM friends, and they all rejected it and thought it was bad. So it probably runs the gamut.
Sorry.
I just want to pose a question out there at some point. If we say, like, we as our little group, we're going to write an article about pornography and how we think it should be talked about, what would we say?
Well, I think that that there ought to be a realistic expectation of human sexuality, and especially male sexuality. And I think there ought to be a discussion about what a good, healthy marriage looks like. And if you have these attributes in your marriage, and then there's pornography going on, that doesn't undermine all those good, healthy things that were going on in your relationship.
I would say beware of the false dichotomy. It's not all or any use is bad. No use is the only good. You know, there's a life is not black and white like Mormons would love to the world to be. And this is more complicated than just saying the only good pornography consumption is no pornography consumption.
So does that mean that we're all okay with pornography use then?
I mean, I think it depends on the couple, because I think this conversation should happen before you get married, because if
the father-in-law and
no, I mean, like, You know, like, if two people are getting married or they're becoming partners or something, they should have that discussion. Because if you know, the wife or whoever it is uncomfortable with any use, then, like, they need to hash that out before they get married, you know, instead of getting married with this, you know, a veil of what's actually reality. And then you get married and you have this huge divorce over something that could have been solved. You know, like, this needs to be discussed, I think. And maybe... every relationship is different, you know, every relationship is different, but it needs to be discussed with them.
If you're that far apart on something like this before getting married, I submit that you're going to be further apart on other things as well, and there's going to be other problems if you can't come together on something like this. I'm not saying you're going to agree, but I'm saying that you can at least come together and understand the other person's perspective enough. But if you're so far apart where she is absolutely zero, you know, any use is destructive, and he's like, I really want to watch it, you know, frequently or whatever. If you're that far apart, there's going to be other issues.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think, okay, this thing can't happen, this thing that Erica, right, it can't happen with Mormon, the Mormon paradigm, because the only right answer for either couple is, yes, we both agree that no pornography is the only way to go.
Yeah.
So this can never happen in a Mormon paradigm, but in the real world, where people date more than 3 months because you're allowed to have sex before you get married. You're not rushing to the ceiling room so that you don't have sex beforehand. You actually have a normal courtship where you get to know each other. This kind of crap is going to come out in a normal 2 to 3 year relationship before you even think about getting married.
And I agree with you, Randy. It's not really realistic to think that you're going to have these conversations in a true believing, in a Mormon, standard Mormon relationship. You're just not, because you're going to both come at from this idea that all pornography is bad, and not even conceive that, well maybe we could get this either a how-to or a video, a Kama Sutra, video, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not even going to be on the radar.
Sutra is all about unselfish sex. I mean, it's all about it being totally in tune with your partner, and they're looking at it as like, oh, I can see the naughty parts. This is bad.
Right, like you know anything about that, Randy. Come on, man.
Hey, Heather.
What?
You know how it's almost midnight over here?
Are you telling me I need to say the discussion continues at MormonExpression.com?
That would be cool.
Okay.
All right. Well, the discussion continues at MormonExpression.com.
All right, son. Tell me about your experience with pornography in your lifetime.
Well, it started when I first found a Sears catalog in my mom's room, and it fell right open to the bra and panties section. In junior high, a friend of mine had a safe, or his dad had a safe, and he had a VHS tape. It was blank and pretty exciting. And it was a cheerleader movie called Debbie Does Dallas. My first real exposure to porn.
Mm-hmm.
In high school, I had another friend whose dad had a subscription to Playboy.
Mm.
And we were able to have free access to those. But then I went on my mission, and that was before the internet, and came home and found the internet and was able to find certain sites of women and their parts. But that's really it. That's all my exposure in my life.
Okay. Is there a history of pornography use in your immediate or extended family?
Well, I do understand that I was conceived during a John Holmes film.
I see. And John Holmes is?
Is the man with a really, really large wang.
How do you define pornography?
Well, generally anything that gives me a boner.
How have you healed from the impact of pornography on your life?
Well, I think I've healed by when I stopped feeling guilty about it.
He appears defensive. Well, and doesn't want to discuss it? Well, who helped you overcome your problems with pornography?
I'd have to say your daughter.
I think we gotta stop this now. There's the door, son.
Okay, I think what Glenn was looking for was more of what you would expect to see.
No!
And then he can do his internal monologue. Matt's, like, given himself.
It's got to be a little more snappy.
Oh, come on, the next two are the best. Just,
all right,
just ask.
All right. How do you currently protect yourself from pornography?
I purchased a splash guard for my keyboard.
Have you ever wanted to stop viewing pornography but couldn't?
No, my refractory period generally takes care of that. That's it. And scene.
Oh, man.